Chapter 7. We followed him inside. Mrs. Desmond had taken down the shutters and kindled the fire, as Charles Hathaway had indicated, but the room was a study in sadness. A chill born of long neglect seemed to have penetrated the very walls of the place. It was quite dark, being panelled in heavy Jacobean oak, and the only illumination came from the pale morning sun.
"I will tell Mrs. Desmond to bring lamps," Lady Hathaway said.
What she meant was that she intended to delegate the chore, for she gave a signal to Effie, who huffed out a tiny sigh and left, clearly annoyed at being left out of whatever grand discoveries she imagined we would make. The room was full of figures, shrouded in dust sheets, and Stoker circled them in anticipation.
"Sir Hugo mentioned there was a thylacine in the collection,"
he ventured. His pupils were dilated, and his breathing was uneven. Anyone who did not know him might imagine him in the throes of amatory anticipation, but I understood exactly what had roused his passions. The prospect of coming face to face with the elusive Tasmanian tiger. Charles Hathaway plucked away one of the dust sheets to reveal a rather morbid-looking stuffed monkey.
"A thylacine? That's the big bird, isn't it? The one with the devilish claw on its foot? Stands as tall as a man?"
"You are thinking of a cassowary,"
Stoker corrected tightly.
"Cassuarius, cassuarius. I am referring to Thylacinus cynocephalus, the Tasmanian tiger. A distinctive-looking animal, stripes on the pelage. Perhaps 4 feet in length with another 2 for the tail, standing just over 2 feet tall and weighing perhaps 60 pounds.
Stoker had been sketching the dimensions with his hands, but Charles gave him a shrug.
"I am afraid I cannot say," he said. "It must be here somewhere, though,"
he added brightly. Lady Hathaway planted her walking stick and wrapped both hands around the ram's head at the top.
"My husband, Sir Geoffrey, was a distinguished collector," she informed Stoker loftily. "He acquired all manner of specimens on his travels throughout Asia and the Antipodes. When we returned from India, many things were simply stored here and never completely unpacked. His priority was building his observatory," she added, pointing upwards with the walking stick. "I dare say he would have got round to sorting the specimens eventually."
Besides the trophies huddling under dust sheets, there were innumerable crates and boxes, pasted with shipping labels and clearly untouched since the Hathaways had resumed living at the Hall. Stoker looked about him with a faint air of desperation.
"We will search them all," I soothed. "Certainly you will," Lady Hathaway put in. "There are treasures to be found in these crates, no matter what Mary might say."
She spoke her granddaughter-in-law's name as if it were a swear word, and Charles made the sort of soothing noises one might make to settle an upset cow.
"Now, Grana, you know Mary just wants the Hall to look its best. The sooner these dusty old things are cleared away, the sooner we can hang the new wallpaper and the paintings she has been buying."
He turned to us.
"This is to be the picture gallery. We mean to commission a painting of Mary and the children to hang here with her collection of still lifes. Very fond of still lifes, is my Mary."
He turned away to help Stoker find a pry bar, and Lady Hathaway muttered under her breath, just loudly enough for me to hear.
"One must question the taste, if not the actual intelligence, of a woman whose greatest interest is painted bowls of fruit."
I turned to her. "You do not approve of Mrs. Hathaway's planned changes to the Hall?" She shrugged.
This is a matter of indifference to me. The hall is nothing, nothing, compared to our house in India. That was a palace, she said.
She leaned near, and I could smell aniseed pastilles on her breath.
An actual palace. In my day, people knew how to treat their betters, she said, her mouth turning down. The Indians were grateful to us, you understand, Miss Speedwell? We brought roads and medicine and education. We showed them how to live.
I resisted the tart rebuttals that came to mind and began to count to 100 as she carried on.
It is all quite different now, of course. The mutiny saw to that.
I realized with a start that she was speaking of the sepoy mutiny. But that was more than 30 years ago, I pointed out. Surely some things have changed for the better.
Well, India is firmly part of the empire now, so one must be pleased about that.
No, one must not, I thought, but did not say.
But so much else has changed for the worse. I do not approve of these new practices, Miss Speedwell, she said sternly. It is bad enough that Mary wants a folly on the moor and a conservatory, but she intends to install flushing water closets, she added in a furious whisper.
I have one at home, I told her. It is far more convenient.
Convenient, she sniffed. What is convenience compared to decency? It is not at all nice to think of pipes and what may be in them. And do you know what else that means? Drains, Miss Speedwell. One cannot think of drains with equanimity.
I made a non-committal noise that I hoped might pass for something akin to sympathy. She shook her head, the jet beads at her ears trembling in outrage.
No, these modern ideas are decidedly not in good taste. But what can you expect from a person not born to the station she now occupies? Mary has married up, you see. Her father was in trade.
The last word was a harsh whisper. But Lady Hathaway, I too earn my living, I replied with a tinge of malice. She curled her lip.
A trifling formality, Miss Speedwell. My grandfather was a marquis, you know. I can spot good breeding at 50 paces, and you have the bones of someone who was very gently bred.
Exactly how gently was something I had no intention of sharing, so I merely murmured a thank you. She flapped a hand.
No call to thank me, child. I simply speak my mind. I have always been thus. I cannot abide deceit. One must speak the truth and shame the devil, as my dear mamma always used to say.
It was astonishing, I mused, how often people claimed to be honest when they were simply making a virtue of excessive rudeness. I thought, too, of the possible impostor beneath her roof, and wondered exactly what she would say if it were revealed that he were, in fact, not Jonathan Hathaway. As if intuiting my thoughts, she leaned closer still, clearly in the mood for confidences.
I will be glad for you to meet my other grandson, Jonathan, she said. He is a very different type to Charles. One loves Charles, of course. He is, after all, family, she said with a sigh. But he is entirely in the thrall of his wife. Jonathan is his own man, she added proudly.
It must be a great consolation to you to have him back, I remarked. Instantly, the withered apple face suffused with pleasure.
He is the delight of my days, she said.
To my astonishment, her eyes filled with tears.
I had missed him so, she whispered.
Impulsively, I covered her hand with my own. She let it lie there a moment, not offended at the familiarity, and then gently withdrew it. She took a large handkerchief from her pocket and applied it to her nose, blowing it with gusto. The corner of the handkerchief flapped, and I could see the cipher that had been worked on it with tiny stitches, a series of pretty French knots and her initials in dark blue. When all traces of moistness had been removed from her face, she tucked the handkerchief away and straightened her shoulders, just as Charles Hathaway gave a little crow of triumph.
"Here now, I have found something," he cried,
tearing one of the dust sheets free. The specimen beneath proved a dusty camelid, some South American creature with too many teeth, and a pelt that had clearly proven irresistible to moth. One fluttered free, darting wildly as it searched for a way out.
"How damnable,"
Charles Hathaway muttered as he clapped his hands, crushing the moth between his palms. He opened his grip and peered at the silvering remains.
"Got him!"
I peered into his hand. "Tiniola biseliella," I informed him. "Your homicidal effort was quite in vain."
"Eh?"
he asked, his brow furrowing in puzzlement. "The common clothes moth, Mr. Hathaway. You have killed a creature which does not feed in its adult stage. Only in the larval form does it take nourishment and wreak havoc with one's woolens, or, in this case, one's camelids." I turned to Stoker. "What is it meant to be?" Stoker surveyed the long, crooked neck, the glass eyes that seemed to be staring in opposite directions, and the ear that drooped sadly as it dangled by one small shred of hide.
"It seems to be an alpaca of some sort, but I shouldn't like to wager on it. Whoever mounted it has done a criminal's work here."
He poked it with a tentative finger, and another moth erupted. This one flapped lazily about, circling Charles Hathaway's head before settling back onto the ersatz alpaca's nose.
"Not a very promising start, I'll grant you," Hathaway said as he dusted his hands. "I will leave you to get on with the specimens at your leisure, and when you have had your fill of the things in this room, there are a few other items that may prove interesting to Lord Rosmoren," he said, giving Stoker a cryptic glance.
"I hope that you are not speaking of my jewels, Charles," his grandmother put in tartly.
Charles gave a start, as if he had forgot she was with us. He summoned a smile that was not entirely convincing.
"Oh, certainly not, Granna. I was thinking of the equipment in Granfer's observatory."
There was a crash in the doorway, as Effie dropped an unlit lamp, splashing oil onto the threadbare carpet.
"Have a care, child," said Lady Hathaway. "That carpet is an aubusson."
If it was an aubusson, it was a particularly nasty one, I thought, and slightly improved by the enormous dark stain from the oil.
"Never mind," Charles muttered.
"You mean to sell Granfer's astronomical instruments?" Effie said,
the second lamp trembling in her hands. Stoker moved forwards with his usual cat-like grace, taking it from her before she could drop this one as well. Charles Hathaway gave his sister an impatient look.
"Effie, it is impolite to discuss such matters in front of our guests."
"They know why they are here,"
she returned, her freckles livid against her fair skin.
"Very well,"
said Charles, pushing a hand through his gingery hair.
"Yes, there is no point in keeping items that are not in use."
"Not in use. I use them," she protested.
"As a hobby, my dear,"
he began.
"It would not be a hobby if I could go to school,"
Effie retorted. Charles shot us an apologetic look.
"Effie, this is not the time."
"For what?" for our guests to find out that I am your penniless drudge, that I labour here, unwaged and unappreciated, because all I am is...
What you are is a helpmeet to your brother's wife,
Lady Hathaway cut in.
As an unmarried girl, you ought to be grateful to Charles and Mary for continuing to provide a home for you. Instead, storms and tears, that is how you repay them.
Effie looked from her brother to her grandmother and back again, before bursting into choked, angry sobs and running from the room. Lady Hathaway sighed.
She is entirely ungovernable. I wonder if I ought to have dosed her more as a child. Castor oil has an improving effect upon the demeanour when applied in large amounts.
With that pronouncement, Lady Hathaway wandered out, leaving us to stare awkwardly at our host.
Families, eh?
He asked, with a sickly smile.
Yours is much less trouble than either of ours,
Stoker told him truthfully.
That is good to know,
Charles said.
I despair of Effie. Granner calls her unmanageable. Any time that she has spare, she spends in Grandfather's observatory, working with his telescopes and other such things. As Mary says, it is unwomanly,
he said, with a little twist of the lips.
I should be perfectly happy to see the things cleared out. Mary wants the observatory for a sewing room, you see, and it would remove the temptation for Effie. I think she would cease to pine then and settle properly to her domestic obligations.
What obligations?
I nearly demanded. As far as I could see, Effie Hathaway had done nothing but have the misfortune to be born into a family distinctly lacking in imagination and grit. She had originality and spirit, and she was in grave danger of having her mettle ground away to nothing.
I am afraid we are thoroughly unqualified to assess any such instruments for the purposes of acquisition for Lord Rosemoran's collection, I said.
I gave Stoker a hard look, and he cleared his throat, turning to Charles Hathaway with an apologetic gesture.
Miss Speedwell is entirely correct. Not our area of expertise, as it were,
he said.
Oh, well, that is a pity. Perhaps you will change your mind,
Charles said. He glanced around the depressing room and seemed to shake off the little drama his family had just enacted.
I should leave you to it. If you need help at all, just send for Anjali. As I've explained, she is Grana's companion, but she will do anything you ask of her. A very biddable and docile creature, always quick to help.
With that, he left us. I turned to Stoker, who lifted one heavy brow in query.
Astronomy is the only life that poor girl has. We are not going to be the means of annihilating it, I told him.
If Mary Hathaway has her heart set on using the observatory for her own purposes, I am quite certain Charles Hathaway will find a means of getting rid of the scientific instruments,
he replied, as he peered beneath a shrouded figure.
Perhaps, I said firmly, but there is no reason for us to aid him in his endeavours.
Chapter 8. We spent the next several minutes in silence, removing dust sheets and acquainting ourselves with the lay of the land, so to speak. The long gallery was, as its name indicates, a chamber some 50 feet in length and perhaps 20 in width. A narrow carpet, once scarlet, although it was impossible to be certain between the hearty appetites of the moths and the wear of many feet, stretched from one end to the other, indicating a path the ladies of the house might once have trod on inclement days. A few smaller patterned rugs were scattered about, none matching. Like those of the great hall, the walls here had been hung with paintings, the marks of the absent frames still visible upon the cracked and warped panelling. A few chairs and benches, heavy with Jacobean carving, were dotted about, but otherwise the room had been given over to displaying the treasures of the natural world. Wardian cases, the glass streaked and murky, stood by terraria whose plants had long withered to dust. I did not dare to peer too closely into the fishbowls. I had just uncovered a particularly nasty trahira, that is, a Brazilian wolffish, when Stoker spoke.
You do not like him.
Of course I do not like him. He has an ignoble face, I said, gesturing to the wide, grinning mouth that displayed rather too many sharp teeth.
Not him. Him,
he said, jerking his chin towards the door through which our host had taken his leave. He is a type, I said, dropping the dust sheet to conceal that grinning mouth. Very John Bull, everything for England, God save the Queen sort of fellow.
Like every other man you meet in this country, Stoker said.
Not you, I protested.
Well, I am remarkable.
His voice was distracted now, and I turned to see he had bent over an unexpectedly lovely little marmot. That you are, I agreed. I do not like the way he speaks to his sister, and I certainly do not like the way he speaks of his grandmother's companion. Anjali, I believe he said. He talks of her as though she was some useful thing to be loaned, a book or a horse.
Don't be ridiculous, Stoker said absently. That sort of man would never loan a horse.
He flicked me a quick smile, and I saw that he was attempting to sweeten my mood. I had been cross ever since we had arrived at Hathaway Hall. No, it was decidedly earlier. When had I first noticed the lowness of spirits that had settled over me? At the first mention of Jonathan Hathaway's name, I realised. I had mourned when I thought him dead along with Harry Spenlove. To hear from Sir Hugo that there was a possibility Jonathan had survived was almost more than I could bear. It touched a rawness within me that I had long buried. I had covered my grief and my anger at their fate. I had moved on with my life. But, like most wounds left in darkness, this one had festered. There were too many emotions warring within me, and I liked none of them. Grief, guilt, sorrow, and rage. That one surprised me. As a woman of science, I prized intellect and reason. I had always attempted to keep my emotions in check whenever they threatened to interfere with logic. I gave vent to them when it was acceptable to do so, of course. I succumbed to laughter, to whimsy, to affection, to desire. I had been exalted in my happiness and occasionally maddened to frustration. But I had only rarely permitted myself to be truly angry. Anger robbed one of sense and perspective, I had always thought. And while I might hone the blade of my tongue, it was always in the service of impatience, annoyance, irritation. And yet, the knowledge that Jonathan Hathaway might have survived the eruption had caused a cataclysmic sort of rage to present itself, simmering just below the surface. My very skin felt hot, as though my blood were fevered. And yet I must master this irrationality, lest I jeopardize the very reason I had come to Hathaway Hall. If Jonathan had survived, then a grave wrong had been done for his younger brother to have taken his inheritance. Charles Hathaway might be playing Jacob to his Esau, and I would see justice done. But if some bounder had inserted himself into this family, unlikable though I found most of them, I would turn that rage upon him, I decided.
Veronica,
Stoker said. I detected from his tone that it was not the first time he had attempted to get my attention. My apologies, I was wool-gathering, I said.
An apt occupation in this place,
Stoker said.
They are sheep mad.
Just then, a soft tap at the door heralded a newcomer. A woman entered, dressed in sober grey. Her hair must have been glossy once, but it was a dusty grey now, although she had troubled to plait it neatly and coil it at her nape. She wore smoked spectacles, which rested just above a small crescent moon birthmark on her cheek. With her eyes obscured, it was impossible to judge her age. Based upon the colourless hair, I guessed her some years older than Mary Hathaway, although she moved with a quick, capable grace.
"Good morning, Miss Speedwell," she said in a low voice. "Sir," she added, inclining her head to Stoker. "Lady Hathaway has requested I come and make myself useful. I am Anjali."
"Do you have a second name, miss?" I gave her an expectant look. If my request startled her, she was too polite to show it.
"Anjali is fine, madam."
I held up a hand. "If we are to work as equals, then we shall certainly speak as equals. I am Veronica, that is Stoker." She inclined her head once more, with all the poise of a duchess.
"Very well. I have brought dust cloths and a basket of supplies," she added. "Brushes, neat's foot oil, beeswax, a few things that might be helpful in cleaning off the worst of the dirt, so you can see what is here."
"Bless you,"
Stoker said, coming to take the basket from her. She moved to the board of mounted butterflies I had just unveiled.
"I know these."
She bent near, her smile wide. "They used to flutter about my grandfather's garden when I was a child."
"Junonia aurithia," I told her. "The blue argus. Handsome little things."
"Indeed," she said, surveying them raptly. "I remember once finding a number of purple caterpillars on my grandfather's violets. I thought to pluck them off and save the pretty flowers, but he scolded me terribly and explained that if we wanted the pretty butterflies, we had to leave the caterpillars alone. He brought me back every day to watch them, as they formed their chrysalides and emerged as the loveliest little butterflies with the patches of blue on their hind wings. Such handsome spots they had, like orange eyes." "You have the makings of a lepidopterist," I told her. She smiled, a rueful expression as she looked over the collection.
"These poor fellows have had a time of it, half of them with the wings broken."
"They were imperfectly stored," I explained. "They ought to have been mounted under glass to protect them. But they are a common enough species. I myself have netted hundreds of them. They would be easy for Mr. Charles Hathaway to replace." Her smile turned enigmatic.
"I do not think he is devoted enough to natural history to make the effort."
"Is nothing salvageable?"
Stoker inquired. "A few," I told him. "And there is a lovely specimen with unique characteristics that would be a good addition to Lord Rosemoran's collection." I pointed it out to Anjali. "See here, where it has the rather subdued brown coloration of the female on one half and the more flamboyant traits of the male on the other. It is called gender duality, and it is rare in butterflies, always worth preserving, if possible." She leant near.
"How curious that the female should be so drab compared to the male."
"A clear demonstration of the value of the female,"
Stoker told her over his shoulder as he uncovered another shrouded case. She blinked behind her smoked spectacles.
"How so?"
"The female can be small and unremarkable and still attract a mate," I replied. "But the male requires something special to secure her attention."
"It is the same with most species,"
Stoker said, not looking up.
The male must always be vigilant that he has shown himself at his best, lest a rival secure a place in her affections.
There was nothing pointed in his words, and yet I felt a glissade of some new coolness in his manner. Anjali looked from him to me, her expression frankly curious, and I dusted my hands briskly. Apart from the dual-gender specimen, there is nothing in this case worth saving.
I fear it is much the same with the small mammals,
Stoker said, frowning at the case he had just uncovered.
Unless we have need of a family of red squirrels dressed as Crusader knights, complete with a tiny castle.
You cannot be serious, I began. But Stoker pointed, and I saw to my horror that he had not exaggerated. A tall mahogany case with large glass panels housed a tableau of 20 or so red squirrels garbed as Crusader knights. They had been arranged in front of a miniature castle, and perched upon the parapet was a little princess squirrel with a hennin, the veil held aloft by stiffened wires. It is appalling, I breathed. I must have it.
Veronica,
he said, a note of warning in his voice.
I will not have that monstrosity in the Belvedere.
Not for myself, for our dear friend Mr. Pennybaker, I corrected. Instantly, his objections dissolved at the mention of the kindly little man who had saved Stoker's life through his swift thinking and skilled intervention at the conclusion of a particularly nasty investigation.
I shall purchase it myself as a present for him,
Stoker said. I pointed to another, smaller case. There is a tiny convent of dormice nuns with a rat abbess. Mind you buy that for him as well. Anjali worked with us, removing dust sheets and folding them with care, dusting where instructed as Stoker and I worked, assessing and making notes. We stopped for luncheon, taken in the great hall with Lady Hathaway. She explained that Charles was out seeing to his sheep, Mary was with the children, Effie had gone to visit her old nurse in a cottage on the moor, and Anjali naturally did not eat with the family. "And Mr. Jonathan Hathaway?" I asked casually. "Does he not take luncheon with you?"
"He does, but today he was feeling a little stronger and thought to take a walk over the moor. The moorland air has recuperative powers, you know. When it is warm enough, I encourage him to go. Each time a little further than the outing before, so as to build up his stamina. He was desperately ill for so long. His colour is much better now," she said with satisfaction. "You may put that down to my excellent nursing."
"Oh," I said, spooning up a bit of thick soup.
"Indeed," she told me, fixing me with her beady bird's stare. "I sat at his bedside and read to him for a quarter of an hour every day without fail, and I instructed Mary and Anjali and Effie how best to care for him, how often to change the bed linen, when to feed him beef tea and nourishing jellies, how much mustard to put into the plasters for his chest. I was extremely thorough. I quite overtaxed myself in my zeal to care for him," she added, with a martyred air. "And now I must walk with a stick until I have recovered my health."
"You must have a greater care for your own strength,"
Stoker said, keeping his expression entirely serious.
"It is very dangerous to let oneself become overtired. It makes you susceptible to all variety of ailments."
"Ailments? My dear Mr. Templeton Vane, do not speak to me of ailments. I have so many," she said plaintively. "I suffer so. The damp, you see, is a trial to my bones, and we shall not speak of my gout.
Some days it is utterly beyond my abilities even to rise from my bed. Only my devotion to my grandchildren and my own will sustain me. I cannot be enslaved to this feeble body," she said, striking one hand against a drooping breast. "I must rally myself in order to see to them. I have no wish but to make certain they are happy."
"How fortunate that your eldest grandson has been returned to the fold,"
Stoker said gently. I grimaced into my soup. Stoker's natural sympathy with women was a dangerous thing. From infants in the pram to women with half a foot in the grave, they fell at his feet, swooning. I put it down to the strange juxtaposition of his appearance, that of a mildly dangerous Elizabethan buccaneer, with his exquisite manners. He was courtly as a Spanish grandee, with an innate kindness that spelt instant attraction for the fairer sex. To encounter a man who looked like a ruthless brigand, only to find him sublimely courteous, was as intoxicating as it was unexpected. And Lady Hathaway was already thoroughly enchanted with him, I realized as I finished my soup. It was to our advantage, of course. The more she liked Stoker, the greater the possibility that she would confide in him, share details of Jonathan Hathaway's story that might provide us with an opportunity either to confirm or deny his identity. I had little doubt that in her desire to acknowledge the putative Jonathan, she would dismiss any snippets of information that indicated he was a pretender. The situation called for rationality, logic, and a dispassionate assessment of the fellow's bona fides.
"It is the answer to prayer," she said, touching the exceptionally ugly jewel at her throat.
I had noticed the brooch. It was impossible not to, for the thing was the size of a child's hand, but only then realized it was a piece of mourning jewelry. She beckoned me to come close and inspect it. It was carved of jet, with loops of ebony beads set in gold. The large central medallion depicted a skeleton weeping over a gravestone, its hideous face grinning out from behind its bony hands. I deplored the current fashion, begun by my grandmother, Queen Victoria, for exuberant mourning, and this piece was one of its more gruesome examples. "Very moving," I said, returning to my seat. Mrs. Desmond had just served a succulent-looking roasted duck, and I was determined to eat it hot. Chapter 9. After luncheon, Stoker and I returned to the long gallery, but I found I was in no fit state for the work. I poked and prodded and scribbled notes, yet my mind wandered continuously. I had just mistaken a tray of Aphrissa statira for Eurema Hecabe when my attention failed completely. I flung my pencil aside, breaking the point. "I must have air," I told Stoker. He was on the far end of the room, his head under a dust sheet as he examined some enormous trophy. He grunted a reply and I left, not bothering to stop for a hat as I strode out of doors. The gardens of the hall were extensive, planted in the Italian style with shrubs instead of flowers, perhaps a wise choice in the difficult growing conditions of the area. Long lawns led to a summer house, which gave on to the rise of moorland beyond. This must be the summer house where they discovered Jonathan Hathaway, I realized as I passed inside. It smelt strongly of new wood, the lavish gingerbread trim so freshly installed it was still shedding sawdust and had not yet been painted. Nor had all the repairs been completed, I saw. A bench sagged along one wall, piled with cracked, empty flower pots, and a large tin watering pot that had once been gaily painted but had faded to an indeterminate grey. New boards were neatly stacked against another wall, along with a variety of woodworking tools. The structure, for all that it was open to the elements, felt oppressive, overlooked as it was by all the rear windows of the hall. There would be little privacy anywhere in the gardens, and privacy was what I craved. I hurried out onto the moor with a sense of escape. It was a different world here, wilder, with long swaths of heather and grasses forming a sort of patchwork against pockets of bracken that swayed in the wind. The expanse was punctuated by boulders that rose from the earth, shrugging off the damp soil like giants rousing themselves from sleep. Narrow paths crisscrossed the moor, and a signpost indicated the direction of the nearest village, Shepton Parva with its tiny railway station, and the closest tor. Feeling a climb would be just the thing to blow the cobwebs from my head, I chose the latter, glad I had worn stout boots instead of slippers. I began to climb, pausing only once to look back at the hall. It was rather less forbidding by day. In the light, it seemed almost embarrassed at its own decline, the very walls appearing to draw back against the hills rising on the other side. The uneven roofline was dotted here and there with gargoyles that I could now see were a sort of stylized sheep, nothing monstrous at all. Against one stone wall, a series of scaffolds had been erected, no doubt for the purposes of repointing and cleaning, for the ivies and mosses of the ages had been tidied away, and the stone glittered starkly grey in the afternoon light. I turned and continued on my way, fairly scampering up the side of the tor. The air was crisp here, smelling of peat and new grass and sheep. The sound of the bellwether rose on the wind, guiding me upwards, and I stopped to admire a small flock in the distance.
"Those are our sheep," a voice called.
I turned to see Effie Hathaway hurrying up behind.
"I hope you do not mind," she said, raising her chin.
It was almost a challenge, and I was glad of it. She seemed to have recovered a little of the spirit Sir Hugo had missed, if his description of her lowness had been accurate.
"I saw you leave the hall and thought I would join you."
"You are a most welcome companion," I assured her.
"Say rather I am a guide," she corrected. "The moor is dangerous for those unfamiliar with its perils."
She raised her hand to point out the dark patches dotted about the moor, some quite near to the paths.
"Bogs," she pronounced. "You must be very careful not to stray into one. They have claimed any number of the sheep, poor stupid things."
"I shall be entirely careful," I promised her.
"You must not venture here without one of us," she insisted. "It looks safe, but it is deceptive."
"I have travelled the world in the course of lepidoptery, Miss Hathaway. I am familiar with every sort of terrain. Jungle, forest, alpine meadow. I can equip myself perfectly well here," I said, beginning to lose patience. In my current state of agitation, I was not prepared to endure a lecture from someone half a decade my junior. I had been in such difficulties before. The jungles of Costa Rica, while teeming with butterflies, are also lavishly dotted with patches of quicksand. I had been taught by my native guide how to extricate myself safely, and indeed had done so upon numerous occasions, though not without incident. Quicksand, it must be noted, is almost always ruinous to one's hat. She was not cowed.
"The moor is different. It's haunted, you know."
I laughed. "Miss Hathaway, I am no schoolchild to be frightened with spectral tales."
"It is true," she insisted. "There is a grey lady that goes abroad in the night. No one knows what she portends, but such things are never good. Then there is the black dog, which is seen roaming the moors when a Hathaway is going to die. There are fairies as well, and piskies who steal babies and confuse travellers. And lately, folk have seen a spectral orb bobbing over the moor, a phantom ball of light that simply vanishes," she added,
snapping her fingers. "You are a person of science," I reminded her. "There must be a rational explanation for these sightings." In fact, I was far likelier than Stoker to entertain the notion that there might be more in existence than our mere mortal senses could discern. I am a firm believer in open-mindedness in these things. Stoker, on the other hand, holds such notions in rank contempt. Whether one should blame his gender or his education for this failure of imagination is a subject for debate at another time. "Who has seen this spectral orb?" I inquired, "and where?" Miss Hathaway pointed and began to climb. "Just here, along the path between the hall and the little cluster of cottages on the other side of the tor. It has been seen several times by cottagers returning home from the village pub." "Inebriates," I said firmly. "It is little wonder they have seen something which defies rational explanation. They are intoxicated. Besides which," I told her, as the wind rose to a low moan, "the moor is an uncanny place. One's imagination could easily run rampant, particularly in the dark." She laid a hand upon my sleeve.
"I have done my part, Miss Speedwell. I have warned you that this is no place to be careless. Oh, look!"
She pointed towards the tor.
"A butterfly!"
It took only a quick look at the mazy flight of the winged thing to identify it. "A fritillary," I corrected. "A pearl-bordered fritillary, if I am not mistaken, although it is impossible to be completely certain at this distance."
"And you without your net," she lamented.
"Never fear, they are quite common, and it is just the beginning of the season. Where this one leads, legions shall follow." We made our way up to the top of the tor, following the meandering path of the fritillary. She flapped away on the wind just as we achieved the pinnacle, but it was no matter. The view was extraordinary, affording a sweeping survey of the landscape in all directions. From above, it was easy to see that the hall lay nestled in a little depression. A small green island in the more muted sea of purples and browns and greens that made up the moorland palette. The hall had been built of heavy grey stone, austere and forbidding, with its few embellishments serving to accentuate its severity rather than softening it. The steeply pitched roof was laced with carved stone coping and pierced with tall, narrow chimneys. Above it all rose a tower, a singularly unique addition, topped as it was with a sort of glass dome.
"That is the observatory," Effie Hathaway told me, a note of pride ringing in her voice. "Granfer built it for his studies, and I use it now. At least for the present," she added bitterly. "Mary wants it for a sewing room because the light is so very good," she said, her voice rising to cruel mimicry of her sister-in-law's refined tones.
Without waiting for a response, she turned her face to the north.
"There is the village of Shepton Parva, where you left the train. To the east, that small cluster of cottages belongs to the estate. Some are let to villagers, but the largest belongs to our old nanny."
"I should like to meet her." There were few retainers as close to a family as the nanny. If she had cared for Jonathan Hathaway in his youth, no doubt she could provide insights that might prove valuable. Effie looked startled.
"She is very old and not always amenable to visitors," she began. "And I thought your interests were those of natural history."
She was entirely correct, of course. Our ostensible purpose for being at the hall was to evaluate the specimens and perhaps acquire a few fresh exemplars for the Lepidoptera collection. But I had the advantage over Effie Hathaway in that she was, for all her awkwardness and grievances, a girl from a good family, which meant she had been trained to be polite in all circumstances. I had not. I bared my teeth in what might have passed for a smile. "I must insist," I told her, setting off down the path.
As there was no cordial way to refuse me, Effie fell into a sullen silence as we trudged down the path to the east. Smoke spiralled out of the cottage's chimney, and warm light glowed behind the thin curtains.
"I will go ahead,"
she called back over her shoulder as she charged through the tiny wicket gate, stomping along in her heavy black brogues.
"Nanny Burnham sometimes sleeps in the afternoons, and I should not like to wake her if she is resting."
It was a pointless excuse. Surely the old woman would be woken by Effie bursting into her cottage. But she went on ahead, and I stopped to admire the small garden. The building itself was low, of native stone, and as austere as the main hall. But the planes of it had been softened by climbing roses and gentle creepers, their leaves just beginning to waken to the spring warmth. A little patch of rhubarb had been planted to take advantage of the sunny side of the cottage, and the front step had been swept and scrubbed to gleaming. After a long moment, Effie appeared in the doorway.
"Nanny Burnham would be very happy to make your acquaintance," she told me.
I stepped inside, taking a moment for my eyes to adjust. The day outside had been gloomy, with clouds scudding their shadows over the moor. But the heath outside had been brighter than this dim cottage. The lamp in the window and the fire on the hearth did little to dispel the shadows. And yet the cottage gave an appearance of cosiness and warmth. A plump calico cat slept in a basket on the hearthstone, and two armchairs had been drawn near. An elderly lady sat in one, a rug spread over her lap to hold her knitting. On the mantel, a neat row of highly polished pewter pieces had been arranged with a few bits of flowery china. A door led off this main room, tightly closed against draughts, I was certain. From the rafters hung an assortment of bundled herbs which scented the air. The woman made to get up, but I made a swift gesture. "Please, do not trouble yourself. You must be Nanny Burnham."
"Aye, and you are Miss Speedwell," she said, resuming her knitting. "Effie, fetch the lady some of my damson wine," she instructed, as the needles clacked together. "It is just the thing for a body when the wind blows from the east," she informed me. Effie did as she was told, taking a bottle and two tiny glasses from a small cabinet in the corner.
"What a comfortable home you have," I said to Nanny Burnham.
"Aye," she remarked placidly. "I was accustomed to living in the hall, of course," she said, with a disapproving twist of the lips. "But when Mrs. Charles Hathaway came to live, I was informed my services would no longer be required, and I was given this cottage. It is small here, but I have all that I require, especially when the young ones come to see me," she added, with a fond glance at Effie.
The girl had poured out our wine and carried the glasses over on a small papier-mâché tray. A "Souvenir of Bristol" was painted around the edge of the tray in scrolling letters.
"Bristol," I said, grasping at conversational straws. "I believe that is where Mr. Jonathan Hathaway entered this country after his recent travels."
Nanny Burnham kept her eyes on her stitches, her lips moving soundlessly as she seemed to count the row.
"It is a fair port," she said finally. "Most every soul who comes to England from the West enters there."
"How unlucky for him to have encountered an accident," I said. "I believe he has had more than his fair share of troubles on his journeys." Nanny Burnham's thin brows rose.
"That he has, missus. A volcano in some godless place was the death of him," she said.
"Or so we thought,"
Effie put in quickly.
"Aye, he has returned to us,"
Nanny Burnham said, adding a few more stitches.
"It is not a godless place," I said quickly. "The people in Java have their own deities,
to whom they are every bit as devoted as any Anglican to the Church of England. Nanny Burnham raised astonished eyes.
Heathens! As devout as good Christian folk. Why, I never heard such a thing.
I hastened to change the subject. I am surprised you are not still in service at the Hall, I said, with more candour than tact. With so many youngsters in the nursery, a nanny of your experience, and with such strong family feeling. I let my voice trail off suggestively, and she rose to the bait.
Mrs. Charles Hathaway thought someone younger might be better, she said with a sniff, and an Irish woman at that.
She stitched on, and I thought she was finished, but when she turned the row, she picked up the thread of the topic once more.
My rheumatics have been troublesome, she allowed, and the hall is terribly draughty. At least, it was until the nurseries were redecorated. I hear there are carpets up there now, thick ones, up to your ankles, she added in a scandalized tone.
I understand the nurseries are very comfortable, I agreed.
Comfortable, she snorted. Children do not require comfortable nurseries. They need plenty of fresh air and wholesome food and exercise. And when they are sad, they need a bit of a cuddle, she added, with a fond look at Effie.
The girl rose and dropped a kiss to her old nanny's cheek.
I never lacked for a cuddle with you around, Nanny B.
Of course not, Poppet,
the old woman said, patting her.
Now, I am tired, and I've dropped more stitches than I have set. Take your friend and leave me for a little doze, won't you?
I rose at once. And as I bade Nanny Burnham farewell, I heard a thud behind the closed door.
Just the cat, she said, waving us on.
Effie and I emerged into the afternoon light. A soft breeze had blown up, smelling of heather and harebells. Effie was looking fierce, and I gave her a questioning glance.
I get so angry with her sometimes I could scream with it, she told me,
her hands curling into small fists. Nanny Burnham?
Mary, she said with an outthrust lip. She is the reason Nanny B has to live in that tiny cottage instead of up at the hall.
Nanny Burnham seems comfortable there, I ventured.
It is smaller and warmer, she allowed, but Mary has decided to move her again. She means to pull down the cottages on this side of the moor and put up a folly, she said, in obvious disgust.
Where will Nanny Burnham go? I asked.
Mary is having Charles build a row of new cottages in Shepton Parver. It will be miles further to walk to see Nanny B, Effie said. But Mary says they will be better for Nanny and the shepherds to live in because they are hygienic.
She carried on, cataloguing her complaints about her sister-in-law, a litany to which I only half listened. I was too busy thinking of the thud behind the door and Nanny Burnham's insistence that it had been the cat. I was thinking, too, of the plump calico that had been curled up on a hearth cushion, never moving for the duration of our visit. And I wondered exactly why Nanny Burnham had lied.